Now? Fine, then I suppose I shall get out of your bed, now. She stalked across the garret, put on his discarded dressing gown, sat at the piano, and struck an ironic discord. He groaned. I'm sorry. Oh, please, never apologise for being professional. He said nothing. Finally, Mary sighed.
What? Well, you don't seem to see the trouble you could make.
For my teaching career, it could hardly get worse. I'm on half pay, and I have half a class of retards, cripples and pariahs. If I were to be sacked, I might consider it a promotion.
You wanted that job.
So what would you have me do? Bow to you in gratitude?
Look, you know I'm in a spot. I want the schools open as much as you do, and yet the policy is to maintain the evacuation. I have a little leeway, but I'm walking a tightrope. You do understand the delicacy?
No, Tom. It never once occurred to me. I suppose it is because you are a man with weighty responsibilities, and I am just a foolish young girl.
Tom held his head and was silent for a minute. All right. Fine. Please may I have Mary back now? She went to ruffle his hair.
Not until you've apologised to Miss North.
Tom took her hand and kissed it. I'm sorry. I am. It's just that keeping the school open is harder than you know, and it's only really doable at all so long as no one, you know, notices.
Do give me some credit. I'm running a school, not a jive club. The children worked all week, and this was half an hour on a Friday afternoon.
Friday, Saturday, or Judgment Day. You dance with a Negro boy, and people will talk.
Mary pulled her hand away.
Don't you suppose they have bigger things to listen to? You know, what with the Germans being so vocal? But you know how people gossip. It's a comfort, isn't it, to fall back on the old prejudices when everything else is in flux. Are we talking about other people's prejudices, darling, or yours?
I'm sorry.
It's just that no one else has complained, have they?
I might have expected a note from a parent or some busybody, but hardly from you.
Mary, please,
don't marry me.
Sorry. But it isn't for us to change how things are. I'm just an administrator. You're just a teacher.
Oh, I hope I don't teach. Because look what we did. We saved the zoo animals and the nice children, and we damned the afflicted and the blacks. You know what I do every day in that classroom? I do everything in my power to make sure those poor souls won't learn the obvious lesson.
Oh, but the peevish expression he gave her. She lit a cigarette. She was angry, she supposed, at more than just him. Even as she railed, a hollow feeling grew that perhaps life would turn out to be like this. Not, after all, the effortful ascent to grace that she had imagined, but rather a gradual accretion of weight and complexity, and not in one great mass that could be shouldered, as Atlas had, but in many mundane and anti-heroic fragments, with a collective tendency to drag one down to the mean. Perhaps life just turned a person who tried harder into a person who felt they must write it on someone else's report.
If I were you, said Tom, I should stick to reading, writing, and arithmetic.
But what good is it to teach a child to count if you don't show him that he counts for something?
Tom held up his hands. I'm sorry, you're losing me.
Mary exhaled smoke.
Possibly I am.
September 1940. The packed 8 o'clock brought Alistair's regiment to Waterloo from their Hampshire barracks. Into the sky, the train disgorged vapours. Into the capital, 60 officers and 300 men. They had 24 hours leave, orders to rest and recuperate, and a tendency to do neither. In his new uniform of a captain in the Royal Artillery, Alistair stood on the platform to wish his men the best. Wills would be drawn up, he supposed, and mothers reassured of sons' immortality, and fathers slipped letters to be opened in case of contradictory news. Blushing sisters would be introduced to suitable fellow officers. Younger brothers issued with gobstoppers and wooden rifles. The enamoured would be betrothed, the betrothed espoused. entire human lives would be conceived in unorthodox locations by hurrying bodies cheerful with wine and still mostly clothed at 2:30 in the afternoon. The Savoy's best spoons would be pocketed, things that were not cricket cricketed. He didn't even like to think. A pair of brother officers invited him to breakfast, but he declined. He invented some quick excuse, an aunt or an aneurysm, which he forgot as soon as he had uttered it, but which the others seemed to find sufficient. In any case, they left without taking offence. Alistair was so adept at this now, at keeping to himself, that he did it without conscious effort. He might have bowed out of this leave entirely if Tom hadn't insisted he come. He watched his battery disperse. Each group of six or a dozen men ringed itself off from the others with laughter of its own particular key. Alistair knew the men well, but he did not know how they formed their clans to go drinking in. He had ministered to them all under fire without making any more distinction than the bullets and the shells had done. By what unobservable law did they now divide themselves into these friendship groups that cut across the lines of their official units? Of course, the men were not cattle, and yet he did not understand how fierce could be the loyalty to this or that faction, while another merited only disdain. And yet that was men for you. There was always this counter-current, this escheresque sleight that they performed without ever seeming to defy their orders. The army made them into a flock of birds, while the men made themselves into shoals of fish, swimming in the contrary direction. His men headed for the pubs in the back streets behind the station, where the licensing hours had been quietly surrendered. The soldiers would drink ale until dusk, and then switch to whiskey in fists. They would fight the Navy, if available, other regiments if not, and the RAF as a last resort, since it was not considered form to bother the afflicted. They would fight for the simple joy of doing so without 7.2-inch howitzers. Then they would return at dawn and call him Sir, with their heels the regulation width apart. Alistair knocked out his pipe on the heel of his shoe. If there was one thing the war had done, it was to change his mind about the class of people who never came into the Tate. Men and good paintings had a genius for escape from the frame. He took a cab to Belgravia, where he had an appointment with the regimental physician. The fare was 2 shillings and a halfpenny, and he handed over a half-crown and told the driver to keep the change. The man blessed him, so Alistair tipped him another shilling. He thought, this might be the last bright blue morning, the last London taxi in its livery, the last quiet shilling with its lion and its crown. It occurred to him that no one who hadn't been in battle could know what things were worth. At the doctor's offices, they kept him waiting in a pink-carpeted anteroom, with 6 Windsor chairs and a large framed print of the King. Looking up at him, Alistair began to feel that the King was an old chum. The King sat alone and rigorously upright in full ceremonial dress with what looked like 10 pounds of medals and braid hanging off it. He rested one gloved hand on the pommel of a ceremonial sword. His expression suggested that he would not hesitate to use the sword on himself or others should the portraitist require him to maintain the pose for one more damnable minute. Alistair's knees jiggled up and down as he sat. This was what he had not understood until the war, that all men were of one blood, embedded from king to serf in a perfectly rigid formalism, and all quietly abstracting themselves from it. The men did it with fighting and cheap women, the officers with theatre and costly ones. Alone in his mind, each man knew himself free as a king, while the king alone knew himself enslaved. Alistair felt euphoric. This was the great joke, and until the war he hadn't got it. These insights were coming to him continuously, and with terrific effervescence after yesterday's god-awful low. He laughed at himself. There was no reason to fret about it. Why should one expect to feel the same every day, in a world that was rearranging itself by the hour? He was pleased with this formulation, and said so to himself. He was pleased with... In fact, no, it was gone. His thoughts were coming so quickly, but no matter. He was pleased with... Well, he was just pleased. The doctor called him in after 10 minutes.
He was a portly man with side whiskers, in a white cotton jacket with gold insignia. The effect, to Alistair's eye, falling somewhere between avuncular surgeon and cruise ship maitre d'. The man remained seated behind his desk, not looking up when Alistair came in.
"Heath,"
he said.
"Doctor." "Be seated. Nothing the matter, I hope?"
"Nothing," said Alistair.
"No aches, pains, unscheduled loss of limbs?"
"I find I don't much care for seafood."
"Good man,"
said the doctor, inking his rubber stamp. Holding it poised over Alistair's paper, he looked up for the first time.
"And how's morale?"
"Mine, or the men's?"
"Isn't it the same thing?"
"Morale is fine," said Alistair.
"France, wasn't it? And then back across from Dunkirk."
"Awful little town.
Not one fish and chip shop." "No inflections of mood? No irritability? No anxiety?"
"No."
"Any shell shock, jellification of the spine, malingering hottentottery?"
"Hardly." The doctor thumped down his stamp and slid the paper over.
"First class. Give this to the CO when you get back to barracks. I dare say you'll be posted soon."
"Looks that way."
"Good luck. Take quinine if it's Cairo. Take salt if it's the desert. Take precautions if it's a local girl. Avoid gin unless good tonic is available. Smoke no more than one pack, and keep anything made of metal on the outside of your skin. Dismiss."
"Thank you," said Alistair, standing.
"Very good."
Alistair hesitated in the doorway. "There is one thing."
"Yes?"
The doctor was fanning the papers on his desk, looking for the next fellows.
"A few of the chaps I was friendly with, well, they didn't make it back from France, and now, well, I do seem to keep myself to myself, rather." "Quite right," said the doctor. "Take it steady until you feel brighter."
But Alistair still hesitated, wondering if there was a better way to put it. The men were good at calling the war a bastard and laughing at the mess it made of one's nerves, but it didn't do to be familiar with the men, and with his brother officers he could not trust himself to keep within bounds. He would find himself coming to, as if from a trance, to hear himself saying something like,
"And I didn't see him after that,"
which imposed on the others the burden of restoring the talk to a more pleasant level. People were good-humoured and patient, but of course one hated to be a weight, and so he tended to take himself away. But now he was making a fuss. It was hardly a medical condition, was it? One could live with a little loneliness. Men lived with ruptured gonads, with missing limbs. Men lived with their mothers-in-law, for pity's sake. He laughed, which was better. The doctor glanced up at him and sighed.
"Look, old man, it's war. There isn't a pill. Find a sweet girl and forget it."
"Thanks," said Alistair, and went down into the street rather pleased with his prescription. He really ought to pay more attention to the whole business of courting. Even in war, you were still more likely to be struck by a woman than by a bullet. It was noon, which meant he was already late to meet Tom for lunch. He headed for Hyde Park and found that he was hurrying, which was surely a good sign. He hoped that he would seem his old self to Tom, that they could simply pick it up where they had left off. And he was intrigued to finally meet Mary and this friend Hilda with whom he was to be set up. Entering Hyde Park, he entertained himself by forming a mental picture of Mary. It was rather sweet that Tom had got himself a girl. She must be steady enough for both of them, and probably thoroughly sensible. Not a head girl type, though. He couldn't see a woman setting her sights on Tom if she were popular enough in that way. Tom was a fine catch, of course, but perhaps for a nice girl who was herself sometimes overlooked. No, Mary would be a practical girl with a motivation to wage what must have been a patient campaign against Tom's tendency to overthink. She would be pretty when she smiled, although perhaps less of a looker than his besotted friend painted her in his letters. She would be round-faced, with round glasses, a little solid of leg, perhaps, and with a propensity for woolens and earnestness. Mary would be a terrific girl. game, good company, the daughter of a mother who also taught, and a father who worked 30 minutes a day longer than his terms of employment strictly required. She would be as poor as Tom was, and all four of them would have a jolly lunch at the modest eatery Tom had proposed in his letter. Putting off the Ritz was how Tom had phrased it. After lunch, they would all go their separate ways, Tom and Mary to an eventual marriage, Hilda to her own future, and Alistair to a rendezvous with the massed armour of the Wehrmacht. Thinking about his imminent deployment, everything about London now moved him as never before. These mannered plains of grass in the park, those calm stone facades that rose above the bordering oaks, the ironed creases in the uniformed trousers of the policeman who stood at Hyde Park Corner directing the traffic with his immaculate white armbands. All these timeless things could be seen more clearly when one had so little time oneself. In 22 hours he would board the train and be gone. Back at barracks, he would oversee the packing of his regiment. Every item would be documented and boxed and catalogued by the quartermaster, from the greatest artillery piece to the smallest dress shirt stud. Then there would be the troopship, Biscay and Gibraltar, deck quoits for the officers and physical jerks for the men. Then it would all begin again. The war, with its fantastic shocks that knocked London out of a man and left him as he found himself now, with no immunity to the wonder of it. He realised that he was standing quite still, eyes moist, halfway across Hyde Park. His pipe had gone out. He was standing by a tree. No, apparently he had taken cover by its trunk. He sweated cold. Dear God. Without any fuss, and by some instinct he had picked up in France, he had found a concealed position. While his mind strayed, his body, unpiloted, had taken cover on a Saturday afternoon as the chimes of ice cream vans sounded. Pigeons paired. Squirrels did their mummery for sandwich crumbs and nuts. The serpentine quivered as couples, in rudderless love, cooled their awkward oars in it. Alistair collected himself and walked on. A crowd was out in the park. Men in uniform nodded to him in nonchalant fraternity. Pretty things swished by in dresses, giving him warm looks from under the brims of their hats. A girl smiled at him, a knockout girl, in a WAF uniform, and it was such a companionable smile that he grinned back, and just as he was thinking of some nice way to introduce himself, her skin took on the uneasy suggestion of bubbling and scorching, and her hand, reaching up to touch her hair, seemed for a moment to be splintered bones that made jagged egress through the white cotton fingers of her gloves.
"I'm sorry," he mumbled and hurried on. "I'm sorry," he said again, long after she was too far away to hear.
It happened from time to time. It was just a maddening tick, like getting a popular jingle stuck in one's head. How one wished that all the gore had never got in there. Still, in this, as in all other things, he felt certain that he would recover. The psyche, after all, could catch its breath again, as one recovered on the landing before tackling the next flight of stairs. In the meantime, one could cheer oneself up, as he did now, by shooting one's cuffs and whistling Sleepy Lagoon. He was still sweating cold, though, and the feeling took several minutes to pass, and wasn't entirely gone even at lunch. The place Tom had booked was at Lancaster Gate, and it was busy. Waiters addressed corks in a good-humoured frenzy, and banged down the dish of the day with no more ceremony than it merited. It smelled brown, looked brown, cost 1 and 6 with a choice of dessert, and wasn't on the ration. Tom rose and waved from a spot by the back wall. Alistair waved back and got so involved with piloting himself and his duffel bag through the tight press of diners that he didn't notice his friend's companions until he reached the table. Alistair smiled his introduction to them, then nodded politely at his friend.
"Excuse me, chum," he said. "You wouldn't have seen a bright-looking chap about your height, only with a sorry excuse for a beard."
Tom stroked his jaw.
"It has grown in rather obligingly, don't you think? Look at you! You look..."
"I know," said Alistair.
At least 20 years younger. It's the fresh air.
They shook hands, and Alistair snatched another look at the women while he hung his jacket on the back of his seat.
He had been right about Mary.
She was a little slimmer than he had guessed, but there were the glasses. Round. Just as he had pictured them. And here was the button nose in the pretty round face that smiled at him now, under nice black hair in a modish pompadour that was fun, if perhaps a little transatlantic. She seemed a charming girl, and he was delighted for Tom. The other woman was a knockout. A redhead with peppy green eyes and a reckless, puckish stamp. Her hands fussed with her napkin. This must be Hilda. She smiled at him gaily, and he realized, with a kick of nerves, that he didn't entirely mind it. He saw now how it would all happen. After lunch, someone would casually suggest the theatre, and naturally he and she would be seated together, and then afterwards they would all go to the dances. She held his eye, nicely and without flirtation, and yet he felt that an acknowledgement was passing between them. But now his stomach fell. He cannot explain to himself the awful ache of melancholy that her simple, chummy smile provoked in him. A man ought to be glad, but her freckled face burned to bones before his eyes. Even when he blinked and her beauty was restored, his morale was left in ashes. Tomorrow he would be gone, and he guessed now, by the leaden sadness her beauty provoked, that he would never return. He broke off the glance, steadied himself, and looked to Tom.
"I'd like you to meet Mary,"
Tom said, putting his arm around the woman Alistair had just been felled by. Alistair smiled gamely, while the universe splintered and reformed itself into this different configuration, with a concussion that none of the other diners seemed to feel.
"How do you do?" said Mary.
"How do you do?" said Alistair, since that was what one said. "And this is Hilda," said Tom, nodding to the girl with the pompadour.
"Delighted," said Alistair.
"I hope you don't mind a gatecrasher," said Hilda, managing to smile effervescently and look perfectly worried both at once. It was a feat which, in another time, he knew he would have found endearing.
"Tell me if a gatecrasher turns up, and I'll tell you if I mind."
Hilda laughed, and they shook hands.
"Tom said you were funny."
"Did he also mention that I was rich and a world-renowned dancer?"
"Behave," said Tom.
And Alistair clicked heels and gave him a deferential salute that set both women giggling. White wine came, and Tom filled their glasses.
"This stuff is actually champagne," he said. "Only the bubbles have been requisitioned to give buoyancy to our submarine fleet. You will see that there have been a lot of changes while you've been away, playing soldiers."
"Apparently the girls have become lovelier," said Alistair, flashing a grin at the women and intending to grace them both equally.
His eyes snagged on Mary's, though, and in his embarrassment he almost blushed. She handled it calmly.
"Hilda is my loveliest friend," she said. "We were at school together."
"I was the frumpy one," said Hilda.
"Not at all," said Alistair,
coming gratefully back to her eyes. A waiter put down 4 dishes of the day, in such a manner that nearly all the gravy stayed on the plates.
"Lamb," he claimed, and took himself off.
Mary prodded at hers with a fork.
"Whatever it may have been, its suffering is over now."
Tom raised his glass.
"Well, here's to us all. May we be as tough as the lamb, and luckier."
"And here's to you two,"
said Alistair, sweeping his glass in an arc that encompassed Tom and Mary. It gave both toast and fealty, and he marvelled that his arm had come up with a perfect movement all on its own.
"Yes," said Hilda. "Aren't they sweet together?"
She smiled at him, and he smiled back, and although he did not want it at all, he saw now how the long day would be, how it must be, with the intimacies between himself and this perfectly nice girl serving as a proof that he was not fascinated by Mary. There was no use making a fuss about it.
"So, Hilda," he said, "tell me about yourself."
She did. After dessert, the women went together to the women's room, and Alistair lit his pipe. Tom's cheeks were flushed with wine,
they had taken a second bottle, and he drew fiercely on one of Mary's craven A's.
"Isn't Mary something?" he said.
"Tom, she's one in a million. One in a thousand million.
Isn't she? Actually,"
he leaned in and dropped his voice,
"it hasn't been plain sailing."
"No?"
"Plus, I have to fight with this voice that insists she's too good for me."
"That voice speaks the truth. If it gives you any racing tips, be sure to let me know immediately."
"Do you suppose I should call the whole thing off?"
"Oh, Tom, I understand that your brain is large and perpetually at war with itself, but I hope it's not unkind to inquire why you don't simply ask her to marry you and let her decide if you're good enough."
"Well..."
"Look, do you believe in the institution of marriage?"
"Of course."
"And you accept that such beautiful lightning cannot strike you twice?"
"Well, yes, I suppose..."
"Then shouldn't you get a ring on her as soon as possible?"
"It's just that I want to pick a moment when everything is going well."
"Tom, there's a blitzkrieg on. Women's hearts are being captured at astonishing speed. You can't just let a girl like that walk around in the wild."
Tom slumped.
"As clear-cut as that, you think?"
Alistair slapped his old friend on the shoulder. The wine made him warm and loose, and there was comfort in falling into their old roles of the sophisticate and the tenderfoot. Drink made everything better. The eye no longer saw what bodies became, the snapped bones and those poor, weeping veins missing their familiar connections. Drink was the warm resin that enveloped living bodies, fixing them in the amber of the present.
"I'm happy for you," Alistair said,
and he meant it.
"I don't know how you've done it, but I can only humbly marvel."
Tom sucked on his cigarette. The women came back to the table, Mary first, with fresh crimson lips and a faint air of soap, Hilda following, her hairdo reinforced with spray, smelling of Vol de Nuit.
"This dive still won't get a gramophone," Hilda said, tapping out a menthol cigarette.
Alistair lit it for her. She cupped her hands around the lighter, holding his for a moment. It was not an unpleasant feeling. He watched her face as she drew against the flame. She was a warm, likeable, undramatic girl. He had 21 hours left in the world.
"What kind of music do you like?"
said Hilda, exhaling.
"Tell us about the war,"
said Mary in the same moment, and then,
"Oh, I'm sorry."
"No, I'm sorry," said Hilda.
Alistair smiled from one to the other with modest neutrality.
"I'm ashamed to admit that I'm no expert on either. I'm afraid you'll think me rather a bore."
"Not at all," said Hilda.
"Yes, rather," said Mary at the same time. She fixed Alistair with a look that was, he felt, principally comic. If there was a certain sharpness to it, the wine took the edge off. He took another sip.
"I like the big bands," he said, struggling to name one. "Something with a bit of zip."
"Oh, I adore the big bands," said Hilda. "Bert Ambrose. Harry Roy."
"Harry Roy," said Alistair. "Now there's a man who knows music."
He hoped Harry Roy was a band leader and not a monkey mascot or a new kind of dance. Hilda seemed delighted, so it was probably all right. Her dimples were nice. He understood that he was seducing her, which it seemed would be achieved simply by remaining in the uniform of a captain in the Royal Artillery until such time as it became appropriate to remove it.
"We only know what we read in the papers," said Mary, lighting a cigarette.
Alistair's nerves sparked when he looked at her. He hoped the jolt wasn't visible in his eyes. How ordinary Hilda was beside Mary, and how shabby his own need for warmth. He took some more wine.
"You probably all know more than I do about the overall situation. I'm afraid they only tell us chaps what we need to know. Come here, look lively, bunk up, dig in."
"Tom tells me you fought the Germans in France," said Mary.
He looked down at his glass.
"Briefly, yes."
"What was it like?"
In her face there was a simple anxiety that he could hardly bear. It made her so tender. He found he couldn't speak.
"Darling," said Tom, putting a hand on her arm. "Oh,
I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's quite all right, Alistair said quickly. She blushed, and he realised that perhaps she was a little drunk too. He was a swine for making the moment awkward. He wondered what he could say, to show by a temperate reply that her question had not been out of place, and also to answer her honestly. But what ought he to tell her? None of it was suitable to relate. The Germans had swooped on them in stiff airframes with bull whistles screaming. Under the hardened sky they had squared off the undulant plain with grey armour. They took the direct line, scorning roads that had wound for millennia. People and animals were spooked. The land had no natural resistance to the pure black method. How could one speak of it over lunch? After the hard planes and the hard tanks had come hard men in hard formations, banging their boots in adamant time. A terrible hardness was how it had seemed to Alistair, a preternatural hardness that ordinary men had fled from, and exceptional men had dashed themselves against, and been ground into the soft French mud, the perfectly regular imprint of the tank tracks making no distinction between corpse and clay. He saw his friends' faces crushed and flattened. He saw Tom's and Hilda's and Mary's faces crushed and flattened. Good God. He was gripping his wine glass. Good God.
The Germans were just well organized, he said. The next time we tangle with them, we'll be organized too.
Mary said, You're just like my father. Alistair was relieved to move on.
And what does your father do?
He's a politician, said Mary, stubbing out her cigarette and holding his eye with an irony that she might be inviting him to share. He couldn't tell. He's MP for the Wensum Valley, said Tom.
Well then, said Alistair, I'm sure you know more than I do about the war picture.
Mary inspected her nails. I'm afraid they only tell us girls what we need to know. Come here, look lively, bunk up, dig in. Alistair laughed, and Mary flashed him a prankish grin. How quickly she could turn in conversation. Hilda, who seemed slightly at sevens with the whole exchange, shook their third wine bottle and proclaimed it empty. She stood slightly unsteadily, and with a clattering of cutlery to the floor.
Oh, come on, you lot! Let's jilt this dump and go somewhere with music.
Alistair took care of the bill. It was true what they said. You couldn't take it with you. And then they were out in the hot blue Saturday afternoon in Hyde Park, Mary and Tom up ahead, arm in arm, and he bringing up the rear with Hilda, who shrugged her cardigan down off her shoulders and smiled up at the sun with half-closed eyes.
"Isn't this grand?"
she said, taking his arm.
"It was stuffy in there."
"Yes," he said. "Grand.
Don't you love the feeling you get when the sun comes out in London?"
Are all the questions this easy?
She laughed and leaned her head on his shoulder as they walked. The feeling of her at his side was pleasant, and now that they were outside and the first overpowering blush of her perfume had mellowed, she smelled warm and rather nice. Up ahead, Mary, in her summer dress and white straw hat, threw her head back and laughed at something Tom had said. Alistair felt unbearable anguish. They bought ices from a kiosk and ate them as they walked. Mary slipped along with the carefree, long-limbed swing of someone on whom the present hour was neither too tight nor too loose. Hilda was saying,
"Can't you just tell straight away sometimes when a person is all right?"
"You're doing it again," he said.
"And you're noticing again, so we're even."
"Isn't it fun to keep score?"
She poked him in the ribs.
"See? Now you're getting it."
Over the streets, the barrage balloons bobbed nicely against a few small cotton puff clouds. Hilda chatted happily. Wherever they were headed, Alistair guessed, it was likely to have wine. The four of them wondered what they might do, since it was too early for dancing and too hot to keep strolling in the sun. A show would be the thing, but in Theatreland nothing seemed to be beginning. It was 4 in the afternoon, and they bumped from place to place until Mary said they should go to the Lyceum. The minstrel troupe was playing there, as it had since forever, and she had a pupil, Zachary, whose father was a performer.
The hoardings had men in frock coats and hats, in blackface, cakewalking across the theatre's facade in their white spats and sticks. A fat white man in cork paint was calling the crowd in.
"Come in, dear fine masters. You never seen such a show in all your life. You never heard such a fine music."
"Must we?" said Tom. "The whole Coons with Canes thing?"
"Oh, but it's done in a knowing way," said Mary. "It's a clin d'œil."
Tom looked to Alistair. "What do you say? It's your leave, after all." Alistair, who had hardly been concentrating, understood that they were waiting on him. The caller, noticing the party's hesitation, stepped up to them with an encircling, ushering gesture that made it seem rudeness not to let him escort them to the box office. His cork paint was unconvincing, a line of sunburned pink skin glistening between the blacking and his collar.
"Forget your cares for an hour," he said, "as we transport you back through the magic of music and laughter to the peaceful world of the plantation, where that good old darky humour lifts its spirits and lightened hearts."
"Must you do that voice?" said Mary.
"Do let's go in," said Hilda.
"It'll be just like on the wireless."
"Indeed, it will be finer," said the caller. "The BBC's troupe ain't got nothing on ours. Here you will hear ballads too bawdy for broadcast, as too airy for the airwaves, and of course all of this comes..."
He addressed himself to the gentleman of the party and dropped the accent. "With your first drink on the house, from a selection of beers, wines and spirits that are not commonly available under the present circumstances."
"Oh, what the hell," said Alistair.
"Ooh,"
said Hilda, clapping her hands. Tom gave them both a sardonic look.
"Oh, Tom," said Mary, "must you spoil today?"
There was an edge in her voice that made Alistair look. He hadn't noticed Tom spoiling anything, but perhaps he had lost the skill of noticing when days were spoiled by anything subtler than shrapnel. He wondered if another drink might help. The theatre was set out with tables in the stalls, and they took one close to the stage. It was agreeable down there, in front of the red velvet curtain, with the gilded columns of the proscenium catching warm glints from the curtain lights. Laughter from a dozen other tables rattled around, and above them conversation buzzed in the high circle. Wine arrived just in time to stop everyone turning to gore. Another bottle followed, and the four of them relaxed in the soft pink glow of the table lamp. Alistair understood that his chair and Hilda's must converge a little with every glass, as Tom's and Mary's were doing on the other side of the table, until without any particular moment having been marked, they found themselves arranged as two couples. Hilda's hand migrated to his knee, Alistair's arm curled around her waist, and there was something sweet and attentive in the way they carefully ignored each other while their bodies achieved all of this on their own. Instead, they laughed especially hard at a joke Mary made, and brought fascinated interest to bear on a long anecdote that poor Tom was struggling to make go nowhere, until finally, as the house lights dimmed and all eyes turned to the stage, Hilda's body was nestled against Alistair's. This thrilled and dismayed him both at once. Through his uniform jacket, he could feel her quick heart. Its fluttering made him sad. Such a tiny pump, the heart. And such an endless flood, life. The audience fell silent, and the curtain came up on darkness. Behind the stage, a red spotlight made a thin sliver of light that rose until it became the uppermost part of a disc, and then a half circle, and then a whole circle rising over the stage. This was the sun, and as it rose, it brightened from red to orange to white. The stage lights came up with it and illuminated the backdrop, a view out over London from the top of a hill, with spires gleaming and barrage balloons tethered above the sweep of the familiar city. There was the Tower with its medieval walls, there St. Paul's aping Rome, and there St. Martin in the Fields, the sober Greek temple impaled from beneath by that hysterical Georgian spire. Alistair brimmed with pleasure to see it spread out in the warm glow of the stage lights. Dear old London, the conflator of all centuries, the pigeon-feeding tramp wearing all her clothes at once.
As the sun rose over the painted city, a chorus of black-faced minstrels processed from the wings. A dozen came in from each side and arranged themselves in a semicircle open to the audience. In a whisper at first, rising in volume as the sun rose, they sang.
Bless this house, O Lord, we pray. Make it safe by night and day.
Whether it was the wine or the city he had missed, or the 17 hours he had left, Alistair found himself overcome as the voices swelled.
Bless these walls so firm and stout, keeping want and trouble out.
After the hymn, a negro made up as a white man took to the stage in top hat and tails and introduced himself as Mr. Interlocutor.
"That's him," whispered Mary. "That's Zachary's father."
The interlocutor leaned in to the microphone.
"In these times of threat and anxiety, when our enemy besets us and we are weighed down with cares, it does the heart good to remember old times, when life, though it was hard, was familiar, and the negroes gathering together would lighten their heavy labors with song and with levity."
One of the chorus men stepped forward, large crimson lips painted over his black face.
"Well, Mr. Interlocutor, I won't be knowing about no levity, excuse my ignorimity."
The audience laughed and applauded, and Alistair laughed with them. It was a kick after the poignancy of the hymn.
"Ah, Mr. Bones," said the interlocutor with affection. "I might have known it would be you."
"Alistair seemed to be me, Mr. Intercalculator. Every time I check, try as I might, I can't seem to wake up looking like you."
Everyone roared. Alistair lit Hilda's cigarette, and she snuggled a little closer.
"And tell me, Mr. Bones, what have you been up to lately?"
"Well, Mr. Inoculator, I've been out and about in the night."
"In the night? Bones? Out?"
"Yes, sir. Why else do you suppose they call it a blackout?"
Thump of a drum, crash of a cymbal. The audience cheered. The interlocutor waved his cane like a baton, and the whole chorus came forward to launch into an upbeat swing of Joshua Fit the Battle of Jericho.
"Aren't they marvellous?" said Hilda, close to Alice's ear.
"Tremendous," said Alistair.
"How many of them do you suppose are actually coloured?"
"Well, I dare say that fellow Bones is, and at least half of the chaps in the chorus line. Hard to tell under all that war paint."
"Aren't they marvellous?" said Hilda again, across the table.
"Terrific," said Tom.
"Terrible," said Mary, laughing. "I mean, don't you think?"
"But it's only a clin d'œil," said Tom.
"Or at least that's what you said." "I know, but the lips, darling, the..."
She popped her eyes wide.
"Oh, come on," said Tom.
"Actually, it's funnier than I thought."
"But so humiliating. I'm sorry I dragged you all to see this."
Tom yawned.
"I'd be surprised if they weren't all earning more than me."
"Yes, well, maybe I should marry one of them,"
said Mary, knocking back the last of her glass. Alistair winked at Tom. It was rather fun to see his old friend in hot water. Mary caught Alistair at it, and gave him a look that seemed to be amused, though whether at him or with him, he couldn't tell. He signalled to the busboy for another bottle of white. By now no one was counting. As the spiritual ended and the applause faded away, the interlocutor clapped his hands and a new backdrop fell. Now they were in Berlin, before a Reichstag with wonky columns and flags with a reversed swastika. Roman standards carried the Reich's eagle with pendulous breasts and a harlot's stockings and suspenders. As the audience laughed and booed, a performer detached himself from the semicircle and dragged a soapbox to center stage where a microphone was standing ready. A single spotlight shone on him. The man was white, and a little rectangular patch had been omitted from his black face to give him the infamous toothbrush moustache in negative. He climbed up on the soapbox, knocked himself off again with an overzealous Nazi salute, then climbed back on again to laughter. The audience settled. From offstage came the sound effect of a wireless being tuned. The performer leaned into the microphone and spread his arms dramatically.
"This is Germany calling! This is Germany calling!"
The audience howled.
In August alone, the German Navy did sink the following British ships. The HMS Pinafore, the African Queen, the good ship Lollipop.
My dear fellow, the interlocutor said, what nonsense.
Oh, you don't believe me? Then tell me, did you see any damn ships coming to port recently?
Well, no, but...
Well then, never doubt what the German wireless be telling you.
He wagged his finger at the audience, who catcalled and jeered.
We ended resistance in all the following countries. Xanadu, El Dorado, Atlantis. Although I think there was something fishy about that last one.
Come on, said Mary. Let's get out of this dive.
Oh, please, said Hilda. Let's give it 5 more minutes.
Mary made a deferential bow. Up on stage, the broadcaster was working himself into a frenzy.
You British have no chance. We know all your secrets. We know everything about your country.
Oh, yes, said the interlocutor. Such as?
Such as the intentions of your leader, that Mr. Winston Chivalry.
Ah, you mean Mr. Winston Churchill.
The audience applauded his name, and the broadcaster leered.
That's right, the skinny guy. We know the man has no fight in him. He'll never attack.
From the audience. Oh, yes, he will. And the broadcaster.
Oh, no, he won't.
As they went back and forth in raucous escalation, the semicircle of singers set up a low, wailing, rising and falling note, quiet at first and then louder, until the broadcaster, finally appearing to notice it, broke off from haranguing the crowd and cupped a hand to listen.
Oh, Lordy, the air raid's warning. Surely not here in Berlin.
As the broadcaster cowered in fear, the audience cheered with delight. The spotlight snapped off, the stage lights fell, and the chorus carried on their wailing, the note rising and falling in the dark. A silver moon rose over the backdrop, which had changed to a blacked-out London by night. The chorus steadied their wailing at its highest pitch, and held it in a clear hum that sounded over the moonlit city. The note sounded long and sweet, and finally rose into I Vow to Thee My Country. Hilda wept. Tom appeared to have something in his eye, and it seemed to Alistair that even Mary was pacified. The curtain fell for the interval. The house lights came up. The interlocutor came out from backstage and sat at a baby grand front of house. He rolled up the sleeves of his tailcoat, propped up the piano lid, cocked his top hat back, and began an incidental.
"Why don't you go over and say hello?" said Tom. "Oh, stop it. I'm ashamed."
"But what did you expect?" said Hilda.
I didn't realise the joke would be quite so much on then.
The interlocutor's right hand rippled up and down the high notes, and his left pressed out the big chords, perfectly steady and regular, a steam hammer cutting out shapes. As he played, he cast his eyes over the tables, smiling at the audience, giving a wink here and mouthing a thank you there, while his hands played automatically. His face was calm under the thick white mask of grease paint. He smiled at the table where the four of them sat, favouring them no more or less than the rest, and then his gaze moved on.
"Doesn't he recognise you?" said Hilda. "Can't you see he has been discreet?" said Mary.
"We all look alike to them, is what it is."
"Go on," said Tom, squeezing Mary's arm. "Go and say hello."
Alistair saw Mary's discomfort. He said, "I'll bet you can't be quite sure it's him." Mary threw him a grateful look.
"I'm not at all sure."
Alistair said,
"He might be the Queen of Sheba under all that paint."
Mary nodded quickly.
I move we get more wine, Alistair said. What does the panel think?
Oh, wine,
said Hilda, clapping her hands as if it were a clever new invention. Alistair signalled and a bottle arrived almost before his arm was fully extended. He filled all four glasses, displacing whatever volume of awkwardness had accumulated. It was obvious that the entire war could be solved in this way. The trick would be to reach for a corkscrew instead, every time some brass hat ordered artillery. The interval ended. The stage lights came up, and the interlocutor climbed up into the beam of the spotlight. He waited for the crowd to settle.
Ladies and gentlemen, though these times are dramatic, the greatest drama in our lives still plays in the theatre of the heart, which is why our next number is a love song. But before we sing slow for you, let's all take a moment to think of our true loves. It could be you're lucky enough to be sitting next to them right now, Or maybe they're far away, posted overseas. Maybe the two of you haven't even met yet, and you are holding the idea of each other.
As he spoke, the sound of the air raid sirens came again. This time it was not the choir singing it. The effect came from offstage, as the wireless effects had done, and it seemed to come from all quarters at once.
So, our next song, said the interlocutor, our slow number, dedicated to those who could not be with us tonight, is a particular favourite of...
The sirens swelled, cutting him off.
Isn't it clever? Whispered Hilda. I wonder how they do it.
But Alistair saw the interlocutor's expression. By the instinct his body had picked up in France, his hand swept the floor at his side and located his uniform cap. His foot reached under the table and drew his duffel bag towards him. As he took hold of it, he felt the hard shape of the jar of Tom's blackberry jam. He had meant for them all to share it at lunch, perhaps with scones, if the restaurant had been able to rustle some up, but now, of course, it would have to wait. That was this war all over. Just when he got comfortable, they dropped the fire curtain. He kissed Hilda on the forehead, told her she was adorable, and took a long, cold drink of the wine. It was ugly when the house lights went up. The stage manager made an announcement no one could hear. People were making a racket, asking what was going on, and soon the theatre was a confusion of people heading for contrary exits. Not in panic, but without decorum either, and not minding if they trod on a few feet. Everyone was in everyone else's way. No one seemed to know if there was a shelter in the theatre, or whether they were supposed to try their luck in the public ones outside, and as a result the whole thing was snarled up and nervous.
"What shall we do?" said Mary to Tom.
Tom looked to Alistair. "What do you think?" Alistair thought it strange that they deferred to him. His khaki was hardly native to these gilded columns and these pink velvet seats. Civilians must surely outrank him in this theatre. He laughed, then realised by their expressions how inappropriate it was. He held tight to the table. Now that he was standing, he understood that he was drunker than strictly necessary. He looked around the chaos of the theatre, the stalls in packed disarray, and the great circle jammed with people trying to circulate in opposite directions. He hadn't a clue what to suggest.
"Miss North?" said a voice from behind them.
The interlocutor had come down to their table. Alistair watched Mary compose herself and smile.
"You need to work on Zachary's writing," she said, offering her hand.
"Yes,"
said the interlocutor as he shook it.
"He uses punctuation as if it were rationed and vowels as if he had hit the motherlode."
From above came anxious voices as the upper circle pushed downstairs.
"Might the rest wait until parents' evening?" said the interlocutor. "Only I came to invite you people to share our basement shelter."
"If you're sure it's no trouble," said Mary.
"Why? What are you going to do? Heckle us?"
The interlocutor led them backstage and down into the theatre's basement. It was arched and vaulted, 20 feet from floor to ceiling at the apex of each vault, and never lower than 15 feet at the pillars. The basement was as long and broad below ground as the theatre was above. It was lit by 100 bulbs swinging on cloth-braided wire. The interlocutor ushered them along a narrow passage that had been cleared between the rolled backdrops and wooden facades and pantomime horses to an area against one wall where the players and crew members were grumbling as they took their seats on wooden benches. Their voices echoed and boomed through the sound box of the basement. The mood was of annoyance. The performance had been hotting up nicely, and here was another false alarm.
"Make yourselves easy," said the interlocutor, and they all sat.
"Isn't it a bore?" said Hilda. "There should be a law that they can't do these drills at the weekend."
The interlocutor put 2 fingers in his mouth to give a whistle, and Zachary appeared from behind a rack of drapes.
"Fetch me the basin," said the interlocutor.
Zachary disappeared and came back with a cloth and a bowl of water, which he set before his father. The interlocutor patted the bench beside him, and Zachary sat down and grinned.
"Good afternoon, Miss North."
"Mary, please. You needn't Miss North me out of school."
"Fine. Then you needn't call me Zachary."
"Oh, what am I to call you?"
"Mr. Lee will do just fine."
Mary smiled.
"Very well, Mr. Lee. I should like you to meet my friends, Mr. Tom Shaw, Miss Hilda Appleby, and Mr. Alistair Heath."
"Good afternoon,"
said Zachary, more shyly.
"Don't say you live down here," said Hilda, rather loud from the wine.
The interlocutor looked up from scrubbing off his stage paint.
"We rent a room above a cobbler's, which is fine except for the hammering. You might say the sole inconvenience is the sole inconvenience."
Tom gave Zachary an avuncular smile. "And you come along to watch?" Zachary looked down at his hands.
"I help out."
"Excuse the boy," said his father. "He's quiet around people."
Tom ruffled Zachary's hair. "No need to be shy, is there? We won't bite." Alistair watched Tom in the lurching light of the bulbs, and wondered if his old friend had always seemed such an ass. Perhaps it was only the wine wearing off, making Tom clumsy and Alistair unkind. He wished he'd thought to bring the bottle down with them.
"And how do you help out with the show?" Hilda was saying.
Zachary shrugged.
"This and that."
"He's here to remind himself what not to do," said the father. "Boy's going to be a lawyer or a physician."
Mary smiled at Zachary.
"That's what you want, is it?"
"Sure,"
his father said.
"That's why it lifts me when he tells me how well he's doing in class."
Zachary looked to Mary, widening his eyes in appeal. She hesitated, then smiled.
"He tries splendidly hard. And anyway, I don't see what's so wrong with what you do. You're marvellously good."
Zachary's father wrung out the face cloth. The milky water ran into the bowl.
"It's a living, I suppose, and we don't bother anyone."
"I have to ask," said Mary, "how do you find it? The show, I mean."
He gave her a steady look.
"How do I find it, Miss North? I walk up the Strand and make a left onto Wellington Street."
"But since you say that you want more for Zachary, I'm wondering if you mean, in some aspects... Oh, it goes without saying that the performance is fabulous, but don't you sometimes find it just a tiny bit..."
"Sure,"
said Zachary's father.
"You'd want more for your child."
"But since you're... Oh, you know, in it, aren't you ever tempted, forgive me, to challenge the attitudes?"
Zachary's father grinned.
"You're the ones fighting evil. We're just the help."
"Oh, stop it," said Mary.
"It's you I feel for. We only do the act twice a day, but you people are on the whole time."
Mary laughed. Hilda sniffed, doing her lips in a tortoiseshell compact.
"Shouldn't we have the all clear by now? How long will they keep us down here?"
"Just till they've rattled their clipboards," said Alistair. "These drills don't mark themselves, you know."
Hilda smiled. Alistair smiled back. It was nice that everyone smiled, although something in her face was awry. Probably this, too, was just the wine wearing off. It was the least pleasant accident of consciousness, and poor Hilda could hardly be blamed for it. 10 minutes ago, he'd been perfectly content with the press of her body. Whenever one thought about happiness, it was because it was wearing off. Tom said,
"I hate to be a bore, but I'm not wonderful with underground spaces. I'm starting to feel queer, truth be told."
"Hear, hear," said Hilda. "I don't see why we should stay put just for the form. Why don't we go to Brown's and have a cocktail? We could all..."
The first bomb hit London with unimagined force. The concussion was unambiguous. First it came to them through the ground. The benches jumped beneath them and everyone yelped. Then the sound came. A deep bass shock, the echoes rolling in the basement's stone vaults.
"Oh, Christ," said Tom. "This is it."
Zachary buried his head in his father's chest. His father held him close, resting his chin on the top of the boy's head, his eyes wide. 3 more detonations came, even louder. Hilda grabbed at Alistair.
"Oh, God."
Her breath came in quick gasps. Alistair patted her hand.
"Try to breathe. We're safe down here."
Zachary's father had his mouth close to the boy's ear.
"The sun shall not smite thee by day, nor the moon by night."
Mary stood abruptly and smoothed her dress.
"I must go to the school."
"What?" said Tom. Mary picked up her handbag.
"Will you come?"
"But why?"
"I have to make sure it's safe. I didn't bar the shutters or anything."
Tom was pale.
"But we can't go out there. It's..."
Mary hesitated. Alistair stood and guided her back to the bench.
"It's just a building," he said. "The doctors can save them every time."
Hilda gasped.
"My parents!"
"They'll be fine too," said Alistair. "They'll have taken shelter as we have." A string of sharper impacts came, much louder and nearer. Hilda shrieked, and shouts came from the players.
"It's all right," Alistair called back. "That's ours. It's anti-aircraft."
The detonations sent dust pouring from the ceiling. Alistair went around to settle people. He got the players to have cigarettes, and one by one they lit up with shaking hands. This was what he always had his men do when they were rattled. Smoke, or brew tea, or write